stool next to Steve Grayson. I want to get home in time to have supper with my family. He'd regretted accepting the man's invite the moment the words had left his mouth. A quick drink, no more, he promised himself, and then he'd be on his way. He caught the bartender's eye, and the man ambled his way. Scanning the bottles arrayed behind the bar, David said, "Lagavulin 16. Neat." "I've got dinner plans myself." Grayson flashed his trademark bright smile. "Seeing someone new." As the man went into detail about his flavor of the month, David's mind drifted. A sense of despondency had seized him, and he knew exactly what had caused it. Putting the picture away again was less about avoidance and more about self-preservation. He accepted the drink from the bartender gratefully, lifting the glass to his lips and taking a swallow. The scorch of the liquor sliding down his throat was welcome. "I saw a Shriver coming out of your office today." Grayson's tone was studiedly casual. "Rumor is he's finally ready to open a place in Columbus. I'm single and willing to relocate, if that's what Kurt decides. In fact..." The other man drained his glass and raised it in a silent signal to the bartender for another. "I'd give my left nut to be the one assigned there full time." That was too damn bad, David mused, as he tilted his glass to his lips again, because he was determined to be the one in that position, should it materialize. "That seems unnecessarily self-destructive." Just like it would be self-destructive to surround himself with reminders of the tragedy that had befallen their family. The thought did nothing to assuage the guilt that lingered. It wasn't a betrayal to his daughter to tuck away her mementos when doing so had helped him heal. That's where he and Claire had always differed, sometimes violently so. His wife insisted on keeping Kelsey's room a shrine. That was a battle he had lost, but when he'd found her hidden copies of the age progression sketches of Kelsey that had been done every couple of years, David had destroyed them over his wife's tearful protests. She seemed to lack even the most basic instinct for her own emotional health, as if steeping herself in misery somehow drew her closer to the daughter they'd lost. "I know exactly what you're planning, you know." Somehow David had lost track of the conversation. "What's that, Steve?" He downed the rest of the scotch and set the glass on the bar, then picked up his coat. "You'll probably advise Kurt against the expansion." There was a dull flush on Grayson's face, and no sign of his signature smile. "A couple of weekends a month in Columbus works right into your plans, doesn't it?" David slipped his arms into his coat, buttoned it. "And what plans are those?" "You tell me." The man's look was knowing. "More than once I've been in town with Kurt or Martin to meet with clients, and I ask at the desk about the second room on the firm's account." Unless the hotel was fully booked, it kept two rooms set aside for the firm's use. Kurt infrequently spent the night, preferring to commute, which meant that the extra room was rarely needed, since the men doubled up. Trepidation clutching in his gut, David gave the other man a knowing look. "Stinson snoring get to you, or were you looking to get lucky those nights?" "Doesn't matter, because sometimes that room wasn't available. You'd reserved it." The blood in David's veins solidified. "You're delusional. How many drinks did you have before I got here?" His words had no discernible effect on the other man. "Know what else I discovered? A couple of times I went to your room, knocked on the door, called the room phone several times, and there was never any answer. You didn't charge the company for the room on those days, though. I checked. So what were you doing in the city, Willard? And where the hell were you?"
"You checked?"
David shoved his hands into his coat pockets where they fisted.
"You seem to have a lot of extra time on your hands. I took Claire to the city for our anniversary once, and we went as a family a couple of times to a concert. You really need to get some help. Your imagination is working overtime."
Without waiting for the other man's reaction, he turned and made his way out of the bar. First the BCI warrant, and now Grayson. David's jaw clenched as he strode rapidly toward the door. His chest was tight, his throat closed. Fresh air. That's all he needed. He elbowed through a cluster of customers gathered near the entrance and pushed the door open. Filled his lungs with a single greedy gulp. But that didn't completely negate the sensation of walls closing in around him.
Special Agent Mark Foster, November 11th, 6:45 p.m. I appreciate your seeing me, Reverend. The Reverend Thomas Mickelson was tall and lean to the point of skeletal. He engulfed Mark's proffered hand in his two bony ones. Welcome, Agent. I'm sorry my schedule wouldn't allow a meeting before now. Bless you for the work you do to assist the victims in our society. His dark eyes were intense and strangely hypnotic. Mark had the fleeting mental image of a swaying cobra, gaze fixed on its prey. It's God's work, as surely as mine is. Thank you. Mark gave a small tug to free his hand. Is there somewhere we can go to talk? I promise I won't take up much of your time. He'd been trying to set up a meet with the man since the day after speaking to Sims, but the pastor had been out of town, according to the church secretary. Of course, please, follow me. Mark shut the door behind him and trailed behind the man through a door to their immediate right. Mickelson snapped on the light switch. Our secretary has an office next to mine. Cindy Long, I believe you spoke on the phone? We did. Mark looked around at the small, cramped space. It was dominated with file cabinets and bookshelves, all of which were crammed to overflowing. A large cross hung behind the pastor's desk, next to a particularly gruesome picture depicting the crucifixion. As you could see when you drove up, our workspaces connect the church to our living quarters. There's a social hall behind the offices that doubles as a conference area. The pastor cleared off a chair in front of a battered metal desk and repositioned the file folders and books atop an already teetering pile on a scarred wooden end table. But there never seems to be enough space. I apologize for the mess. He waved Mark to a chair before rounding the desk and seating himself. I'm trying to put the Christmas curriculum together for our Wednesday worship groups. Catching Mark's eye, he added, that's like Sunday school during the week for kids, in case you're not a churchgoer. He wasn't, although Kelly occasionally took Nicky. Maybe that was something he should rethink once his wife was back home. A trusted pastor might be able to recommend resources for them. Although Mark was speaking to Kelly and his son nearly nightly, he wasn't communicating in any significant way with his wife. There was a stiltedness between them that only seemed to grow with each passing day. Damned if he knew how to fix it. Reaching into his pocket, he withdrew a notebook and pen. Some of the agents had embraced technology and used a portable digital tablet for interviews. It probably would save time when it came to completing reports, but Mark preferred writing to tapping keys. He'd stick to pen and paper until forced to make the change. As your secretary probably mentioned, I'm investigating the Whitney DeVries disappearance. I'm told she attended services at your church. Mickelson nodded. Occasionally, although her family aren't members. Well, he corrected himself, at least not her parents. She would sometimes come with her grandmother, Helen DeVries. When was the last time you saw her? Pursing his lips, Mickelson thought for a moment. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to be very exact. 3 months ago, perhaps. Maybe a bit less. She's here more often in the summer. I assume she spends more time with Helen then than she does during the school year.
So she doesn't attend Wednesday worship?
No, that's only for church members, I'm afraid.
What about church camp?
She attended twice.
Mark's head swiveled toward the new voice. A stout woman entered the room, balancing a loaded tray with remarkable ease. She made her way over to the pastor with a cluck of disapproval.
That mess on your table is going to end up on the floor,
she scolded the man. Setting the tray down on his desk, she proceeded to pour coffee and load cookies onto plates.
Not last summer, though. Probably not the one before that, either. Once the girls start thinking about nothing more than boys' clothes and godless music, we tend to lose their participation.
Laura, the pastor admonished, a gentle tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit.
The mouth of the righteous utters wisdom, and his tongue speaks justice,
the woman retorted. She turned with a grace belied by her girth and thrust a coffee cup balanced on a plate toward Mark.
My wife, Laura, Mickelson said belatedly. She helps a great deal with the youth groups.
We established a tri-county church camp for children the year we arrived here.
Laura Mickelson wore her graying hair wound tightly in a bun, and her high-necked dress hit her at mid-calf.
With so many small towns in the area, it's almost impossible for each church to put on its own activities. By pooling our resources, we can serve more children and offer a greater array of services.
We can look up the exact dates that Whitney attended.
The pastor picked up a cookie and bit into it with relish.
Laura keeps very exact records. The partner churches send out invitations to youth events to all the families in the area with kids ages 5 to 18.
Under Laura Mickelson's gimlet stare, Mark set his notebook down and picked up the coffee. Sipped. She gave a sniff as she added,
Not that we have many camp participants as the children get older. They are involved in sports and clubs and running around, the likes of which we never saw growing up. I'm better off studying a Bible, if you ask me.
Because it seemed expected, Mark exchanged the coffee for a cookie. Family life has certainly gotten busier.
But not godlier.
Thank you for the refreshments, Laura.
Although the pastor's tone was mild enough, it also held a command.
That will be all.
With another loud sniff, the woman headed for the door.
I'll be back for the dishes later.
Before you go, Laura Mickelson stopped at Mark's words, turned. He shot her a smile, one that didn't soften her grim visage appreciably. I'm interested in your observations about Whitney. His gaze shifted to the pastor. Both of you.
A sweet girl,
the reverend began.
Quiet enough,
his wife added grudgingly.
But she could be impertinent when surrounded by a gaggle of her friends and easily distracted.
Did you ever notice anyone hanging around her? When adults paying her more attention than the rest of the children?
Pastors and volunteers from other participating churches would be present on a revolving basis,
the reverend said.
We always have several different age groups to cover, and some of the older children would also help out.
Between the two of you, perhaps you could make a list of everyone involved with the camp the years Whitney attended? It was a long shot, but Mark couldn't ignore the fact that both Whitney and Kelsey Willard had attended the church and camp at some point. It was one of the few connections between the girls that he'd discovered. There was also Sims's reference to Mickelson's lack of alibi for the night Kelsey had gone missing. Mark had double-checked the case files. They corroborated Sims's assertion.
Oh, dear,
the pastor shrugged helplessly.
That was so long ago. I'm not sure I could recall.
Most of that information would be in my files,
Laura asserted proudly.
As well as the attendance for volunteers and other campgoers. An adult who couldn't be counted on to show up wasn't asked to help again.
Interest pinged. Mark asked, How far back would those files go?
Since we arrived, as I noted earlier. I'll get them for you. They're in the church office.
She flicked a disdainful glance around her husband's space.
I share it with the secretary, but it's much more organized.
Without waiting for a response, she bustled out of the door.
Laura's organizational skills are one of her gifts.
Polishing off the last of the cookie, the reverend wiped his hands on a napkin.
I'm so glad we're going to be able to help you after all.
Do you remember where you were on October 30th, the night Whitney DeVries went missing? When did you hear about it? Mickelson thought for a moment, then leaned forward to consult a desk calendar that looked as untidy as his office. Flipping through the pages, he finally settled on one.
October 30. That was a Friday.
Ah! He tapped a bony forefinger on the page.
Yes, I received a crisis call that night at about 7:30.
Mark set his plate and mug on the tray before leaning back again and picking up his pen. A crisis call?
The police station had responded to a domestic disturbance at the home of one of my church members. Fortunately, they allowed the couple to phone me and I was able to go and help.
Mark jotted down this information. You went alone?
Oh, no.
Mickelson sent a quick look at the doorway before selecting another cookie.
Laura frequently accompanies me on home visits.
The members find her such a comfort in times of need. Comfort? Mark schooled his features to impassivity. Somehow he couldn't imagine the woman as a calming influence. So you and your wife went to help one of your congregation members. You recall when you returned? The man took a bite of the cookie and contemplated as he chewed. Swallowing, he answered.
It was several hours later, but we were home before 11:30. Then we said some extra prayers before bed, as we always do when one of our members is in distress.
He took another bite. Whitney DeVries' cell phone records had indicated the last communications on her phone had been after midnight on October 31st. One number had belonged to her friend Macy Odegaard, the other presumably belonged to her kidnapper, which meant that just like in the Willard case, the pastor had no alibi other than his wife. Do you recall when you heard of Whitney's disappearance?
Oh, I'm sure Laura would have told me. She has her finger on the pulse of everything that happens in the area.
An interesting choice of words for what some might describe as gossip. Mark decided to level the same question at the man's wife. Do you also have lists of other people who might not have been directly affiliated with running the church camps, repairmen, groundskeepers, the people who clean the church?
We work with volunteers as much as possible to keep costs down, but several churches in the area employ the same janitor.
He set the cookie on his plate and pulled open his center desk drawer, withdrawing a notepad and pen.
We still hire someone to push snow, but we no longer pay for lawn care.
He began to scribble down some names.
Years ago, we employed Whitney's father to take care of it for a summer, though I tend to think his mother might have pressured him into agreeing to do it.
Everything inside Mark stilled. Brian DeVries worked for you? Or all the area churches?
All of them, he smiled. It was a big job for one person. Now we have volunteers share the duty.
What year was that? It had been 7 years ago, in September, that Kelsey had been snatched. The Reverend looked confused.
I really couldn't say. He'd probably recall it better than me.
Mark's smile was grim. I'll be sure and ask him, because that was yet another thing DeVries hadn't bothered to share. If you recall any other volunteers that might have been helping on a regular basis, I'd appreciate their names as well. The pastor looked pained, but dutifully began writing again. Laura Mickelson returned with the lists she'd promised, and after taking them, Mark asked her several of the same questions he had of her husband. She'd learned of Whitney's disappearance from the girl's grandmother, the woman asserted. She verified her husband's account of their whereabouts on the night the girl disappeared, as well as the timeline. And her memory appeared much more accurate than her husband's when it came to volunteers, including DeVries, as she added several names of people who worked in the kitchen and on various fundraisers. Collecting the papers from her and her husband, Mark rose after jotting a note to check with the Saxon Falls Police Department to corroborate their account of the domestic dispute the Mickelsons claimed to have been called to. An undisguised expression of relief on his lean face, the pastor walked him to the door.
I hope we've been of some help.
I appreciate your assistance. Mark turned slightly to include Laura, who was following closely behind him. She nodded serenely.
Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due, when it is in your power to act.
Mark couldn't rely on any personal knowledge, but given her pious tone, he assumed she was once again quoting the Bible. When Reverend Mickelson pulled open the door, Mark stopped, stared. Pinpoints of light punctuated the darkness in a semicircle in front of the structure. A murmur of voices could be heard chanting, but the words were indistinct. What's this?
Some of our members have joined together in the evenings to pray about the evil that has touched our church twice now in the last few years. Two young girls have been sacrificed so far because of the growth of feminism in our country. We pray to God for his forgiveness and to show us a way to promote the proper role for men and women in our society.
Mark stared hard at the man. The only one responsible for the evil visited on those two girls is the offender. He alone is responsible for the crime, and we don't know his motivation. If they did, they'd be a lot closer to catching the man.
God has shown us his motivation.
The dim lighting gave Mickelson's face an unearthly glow.
It's our responsibility to right the societal wrongs that led to these crimes.
Mark paused in the doorway of the hotel. Sloane Medford was bent over her laptop, which was placed in the center of one of the folding tables in the room that Ben Craw had last occupied.
I got subs. Yours is in the bag.
Sloane didn't look up as she uttered the words. Mark had added a table since Craw had left, as the files and reports had slowly grown. With the other man in it, the room had always seemed more workspace than personal. Sloane's occupancy had changed all that. Her boots were sitting just inside the door. Functional snow boots, but tall and fur-trimmed, decidedly feminine. Her red-fitted wool coat hung over the back of one of the desk chairs. She discarded her suit jacket on the bed, revealing a silky white blouse.
In or out, Foster?
She didn't look his way.
You letting the cold air in?
Blowing out a breath, Mark stepped inside. Any trepidation he felt from working with her again seemed to be unreciprocated. She'd been nothing but businesslike since her arrival. Locking the door behind him, he went to the fast food bag and withdrew the remaining sandwich. Unwrapping it, he took a bite, then set down the files the Mickelsons had given him, and struggled out of his coat while he ate, talking in between bites.
What'd you learn from Dane Starkey's family?
When they'd split up assignments that morning, she'd agreed to contact them.
Nothing earth-shaking.
She looked up then, and her fingers paused on the keyboard. It occurred to him for the first time that she must have been writing her report for the day, something he still had to do.
According to the 9 members of Shelley Starkey Cohen's extended family that I spoke to, Dane Starkey was telling the truth about the incident 22 years ago. The DeVrieses had lived in the neighborhood only for a few months, but Brian DeVries spent some time at the Starkey house visiting Lewis, who was his age. Shelley was Lewis's sister. The alleged sexual assault took place in a bathroom in the basement. Shelley kept quiet for a couple of days until she finally spilled the whole sordid story to her mother. I take it her father went over to the DeVries house out for blood. From the sounds of things, Brian's mother paid them not to report it to the police in return for putting Brian in counseling and moving out of the neighborhood.
She pushed back a strand of blonde hair that had escaped from the intricate knot at her nape.
A couple of months later, Brian and his mother relocated to Saxon Falls.
I still can't believe none of this would have shown up in a background check. She lifted a shoulder.
The DeVries family didn't live at that Columbus address long. Brian probably fudged the dates on his application. The years at his former Columbus address would have matched up even if the exact months didn't. It'd be easy to overlook, even if someone was paying attention.
You pulled property records for each of the Starkey family members on the list? Technically, Sloane was now the senior member on the case. She had 4 years more experience than Mark, but he had the most time on this particular case, so for now she was following his lead.
I didn't find any more than you had.
Damn it. He finished wolfing down the sandwich and wadded up the wrapper in one fist. Dane Starkey's alibi had been unshakable. He'd been in a poker game with 3 other people in Westerville, a half hour from Columbus. Even if Mark had been able to poke holes in any of the 3 men's stories, footage from traffic cameras had solidified Starkey's claim. He'd been nowhere near Saxon Falls the night Whitney DeVries had been taken. But his large, extended family had even more reason to hate Brian DeVries than Dane did. They were still running down the alibis of each of them, including Shelley's husband. So far, nothing was panning out, and if no one in the family owned any property outside of their family homes, where would they have taken Whitney DeVries if one of them had snatched her?
Oh,
Sloane made a faux purr of sympathy.
I recognize that expression. Your prime suspect isn't looking especially shiny anymore. Don't get discouraged. I still have to check out all their alibis for October 30th.
I'm not ready to pull the other investigators off him yet, but she was right. He'd taken the man apart, figuratively at least. Starkey might have the motive for kidnapping Whitney, but given his alibi, he would have needed help. The man's bank record showed that he hadn't shared any of the money DeVries had paid him. and while making DeVries suffer by kidnapping his daughter might have appealed to him, it also would have interfered with the man's willingness to pay the final installment of the blackmail. Starkey should have immediately come to mind once Whitney went missing, but Brian hadn't given his name to BCI. Mark considered that omission damning.
"Have you faced DeVries with all this yet?"
He shook his head, picking up the files and crossing to the table to pull out a seat next to hers. "I wanted to see where the Starkey thing went first. I'm betting he was the first one DeVries suspected, too. He'd have to. What kind of father doesn't share that kind of detail with the cops when his kid goes missing?"
"One with something to hide? We have to wonder if he ever outgrew his taste for teenage or near-teen girls."
He exchanged a look with her. They were often on the same wavelength. On the last case they'd worked together, he'd thought that quality made them good teammates, which showed how far off base his impressions could be. "Today I found out he omitted something else." Briefly, he told her about the man's connection to the church. "We need to discover what year he was doing the mowing, and if it was anywhere around where the camp was held." He held up the papers. "These might tell us." He spread the pages out on the table in front of him.
"Did you get anything else from the pastor about the girls? He knew Kelsey Willard too, right?"
Mark had to give Sloane credit. She caught up on the case remarkably fast since her arrival. He knew her, but provided no details that weren't in the report. "But our meeting did take a turn for weird before I left." Briefly, he told her about his final conversation with the pastor. She didn't appear as shocked as he'd been by it.
"Sounds like one of the radical religious types who blames natural disasters on any social agenda they happen to disagree with. Believe me, they're far more common than you might think."
Laura Mickelson said Brian DeVries had helped out 10 or 11 years ago. He flipped through the pages Laura had given him until he found the ones detailing the youth camp participants by year. Skimmed until Willard's name jumped out at him.
Kelsey would have been...
He did some quick figuring in his head.
10 the last time she went to the camp.
She leaned in to read the list in his hand, close enough that her hair tickled his jaw. Dropping the papers, Mark lurched from his chair as though he'd been scorched.
"We need to nail down the date DeVries was there. See if it correlates."
Even if the times coincided, it didn't tie the man to Willard's disappearance or Whitney's. But it would be another connection, and add to the mountain of explaining the man had to do. He pulled out his cell, checked the time.
"I have to call home."
Even if Kelly wasn't exactly communicative lately, he wanted to talk to Nikki before his son went to bed.
"Go ahead. I'm gonna change into something more comfortable. I assume it'll be another late night."
The words gave his feet wings. He practically ran for the adjoining door that led to his room. His hand was on the knob when Sloane said,
"Give my regards to your wife."
The words transported him to the last time the two of them had worked a case, when their focus had switched from the investigation to each other. A mental picture flashed across his mind, the two of them on the bed, bodies tangled, clothes pooled on the floor. His last remaining brain cell was all that had prevented him from making the biggest mistake of his life, and as he'd rolled off the mattress, headed to his room, she'd uttered the same remark.
"Give my regards to your wife."
Mark responded the way he should have then. "Go to hell, Sloane."
Whitney DeVries, November 12th, 6:12 p.m.
"Much better, Whitney. I applaud the way you kept your word and tried harder today."
She kept her head down so he wouldn't see the hatred that would surely show on her face. "Thank you."
"Thank you what?"
Her teeth ground. She had to choke the words out. "Thank you, Daddy." A wave of revulsion swept over her. As if she could ever be related to this monster. She'd say whatever was necessary to spare herself another whipping. But still, every time she called him by the name he insisted on, it felt like a betrayal to her real family, who were still alive. Since last night, she'd grown more convinced of that by the minute. The words Kelsey Willard had written had been echoing in her brain all day, had stoked the growing conviction that the freak had constructed an elaborate lie, one guaranteed to make Whitney feel alone, desolate, with no one else to rely on. She hated him more than that for anything else, even the beatings.
I realize that this routine is more difficult, but you're so accomplished. I skipped a couple of films to provide you with a challenge. Had it proven too much for you, I would have moved you back. But your effort today proved that my first inclination was correct. You have a natural ability that's rare. Innate talent can make up for a lack of training, although you had that as well.
A thread of disapproval entered his voice.
I would never have allowed you to squander that by quitting your lessons. But that's a moot point now.
Despair filtered through her. She tried to think about her family, about the people who would be looking for her. Her dad was a deputy. The whole sheriff's office would be helping search. But she had no idea where she was. How long she'd been unconscious before she'd awakened in this place. Had it been hours? Days? She could have been taken across the country. A shuddering breath lodged in her throat at the thought.
Although film is not as interactive as a live teacher, you can be assured you're receiving the finest instruction.
A memory stirred. Maybe learning all about him will get me out. Kelsey had been right. The more details she could find out about the freak, the better. Perhaps she'd be able to figure out where they were from something he shared. Did your mother make these films while she was still in New York City? He'd said she'd been a ballerina there. Were they in New York now?
No. She made them so my sister could practice even when Mother was gone. She worked quite hard to provide for both of us. I helped out by doing all the chores around the house. That sort of work ethic is sorely lacking in children today.
If kids are so rotten, why do you keep kidnapping them? She thought mutinously. Two of them, at least. What had happened to Kelsey Willard? What was his plan after ripping them from their homes? A trickle of fear snaked down her spine.
Children these days take too much for granted, he lectured. Even their families.
She watched his shadowy outline, trying to get an idea of how tall he was, how big. If she wasn't able to see his face, it would help to at least observe his general height and weight. But his shadow against the backdrop of lighting from the computer screen and projector was elongated, narrow. It would be hard to get an accurate idea of his appearance from it. Somehow, she thought he knew that, too.
Once children are old enough, they should contribute to the family unit. Love and acceptance must be earned. If you learn your lessons well enough, perhaps in time you'll be given that opportunity with our family.
Our. Her mind seized on the word. Were there others here, then? Perhaps Kelsey wasn't dead or escaped. Maybe she'd graduated to another space in this man's house. The thought didn't make Whitney feel any better. It wasn't just freedom from this dungeon she wanted, but escape from the freak altogether. She wanted to go home. Kelsey had written that she'd been down here for a year. Whitney thought it might have been 2 weeks or so since she'd been taken. The thought of being here 12 months, or longer, made her want to weep.
You haven't responded, Whitney.
The censure in his voice jolted her from her reverie. I'm sorry. I was thinking about what you said earlier. What had he been saying? Her mind scrambled frantically to recall his words. About kids contributing to the family. I don't know how I'm contributing anything.
At this point, your contribution is your effort. Your cooperation in following the rules I've outlined. And your acceptance of your new life. Your gratitude for the privileges I allow you.
I am grateful. For allowing her to watch a kiddie show? For chaining her up like an animal? Not for the first time, she wondered if the monster was insane. Somehow that didn't make her feel better.
We'll see. If you do well tomorrow, you'll earn back 30 minutes of TV privileges. For this evening, I suggest you spend the hours before bedtime in quiet contemplation of how you can prove your gratitude and acceptance.
He turned off the projector but left the computer on. She listened carefully. Could hear his sure steps as he retreated. A slight scraping sound, then a door being opened. Closed. The scraping sound was repeated. The sound of a key in a lock? That would mean even if she got loose from the chain around her wrist, she'd have to get through a locked door to get out of here. Her shoulders slumped dejectedly. She knew better than to go to the mattress. That wasn't allowed until 9 o'clock p.m. An alert would beep on the computer, warning her it was time to get ready for bed. 15 minutes later, it would switch off. The only hours he couldn't observe her were at night, in the dark. A thread of desolation snaked through her. There was no way out, no escape. Blinking back the tears that threatened, she remained motionless as if locked in the contemplation he'd demanded. He'd be checking on her while the computer was on, even though the screen was blank, emitting only a white glow. He'd know whether she'd followed his instructions, or whether she gave the appearance of doing so. A thread of defiance returned. What did she learn from his appearance here today? Nothing that would aid in a description of him. But she knew he carried a key with him to let himself in and out of the area below the stage. What else? She thought hard. His steps toward the door hadn't been hesitant, although he'd been walking into shadows, which meant he had the way memorized. Or he didn't have to worry about running into any obstacles, because there weren't any. She squinted into the darkness, but as usual could see nothing. But wait, that wasn't true. The projector would have to be elevated in order to beam the film at the stage wall behind her. So it had to be set on a table or stool of some kind. The space directly ahead of it and around it was empty. The glow of the screen showed nothing in its vicinity. Whitney wasn't sure how any of that helped. But she tucked away the observations in any case. Because if nothing else, she liked knowing that when he checked on her, he'd see a girl with her head bowed submissively. He wouldn't suspect that she was filing away details that just might aid in her escape. She'd fallen asleep. Whitney bolted upright on the mattress, rubbing at her eyes. How had that happened? She rolled off the edge, wincing a little as the action pulled at the skin surrounding the fresh wound on her back. What time was it? Impossible to tell, but the light hemming the sides of the curtain told her it was no longer night. Early morning, perhaps. Damn. She hurried to the shower to retrieve the screw. Retraced her steps to pry up the board again. Took out the papers and carried them over to the window. Unrolled them and tried to find her place from the night before. Reading about Kelsey's experiences might provide ideas for escape. I try to learn as much about him as I can. His mother was a ballerina. His sister danced too. And he has a wife somewhere. Is she in this place as well? Does she know that I'm down here? Because if she does, she has to be as much a monster as he is. I still haven't figured out why I was taken. What made him pick me? Did he just happen to see me on the road that day? I wasn't paying attention. I was too upset to notice the van until it was too late. Or had he already selected me and had been watching me for a while? That creeps me out even more. Why am I here? He's hurt me. Badly. Time and time again. But he's never gotten close enough that I can see his face. The movies would say that's a good thing. That maybe it means he'll let me go eventually. But I know that's not true. He isn't going to release me. He has plans for me. But it's hard to figure out what they are. All he talks about is character and being grateful. Earning my place. As if I want to stay and be a part of whatever sick thing he's running here. Whitney had to stop reading. It was too familiar. She'd had a similar conversation with the freak last night. Knowing that he was playing out the same scenario with her as he had with the girl he'd taken before didn't make her feel better. It made her feel like a puppet, a thing, like a piece of clay to be molded into a shape of his choosing. Kelsey hadn't allowed herself to be molded. She just pretended. That was probably smart. But Whitney didn't know if she could be that good an actress for any length of time. Returning to the sheets in her hands, she moved them on the wall until they were positioned in a dim slant of light. He lets you earn things for good behavior, and after a while, I started requesting things I wanted instead of the lame stuff he offered. Like a big sketch pad and a pencil. I'm good at drawing. The words were followed by a small sketch of a girl with long dark hair with her eyes crossed and her tongue out. But despite the silliness of the picture, it was good, detailed. It looked like a real person, and not the stick figure Whitney would be able to draw. So I filled the pad up with my artwork, of my room, my family, places I've seen, and I carefully tear out a page or two in between to write on. Because he'll look at the pad sometime. Nothing is allowed to be private here. but these pages will be, because I've figured out a way to hide them. If only I could find a way to hide myself. Sometimes I miss my family so much, it's like my heart is ripping in two. I can hear my mom's laugh, or see Janie clowning around in my room with one of the tiaras I won in those kitty pageants. I remember the way it used to be, just the four of us. And other times I hate my father so much that I don't want to see him ever again. He's the reason I left the house that day. He's the reason I was so sad and angry those last few weeks, our secret weighing me down like an anchor. I'm here because of him. Sometimes I dream that he's the one who brought me here. Whitney's nape prickled, uneasy at the raw emotion in the words. But an instant later, her attention was yanked away by a tiny scratching sound. A key in the lock of the door. Panic speared through her. The day's meals were always on the edge of the stage when she got up. Never had she been awake when he brought them. There was no time to put the papers away, to replace the board beneath the mattress. She had a split second to consider her options. There wasn't a pillowcase or sheet on the mattress. But the dated nightgown she wore was baggy. The door began to open. Frantically, she rolled the papers up and sprinted on tiptoe back to the mattress as she shoved them beneath the nightgown. The screw she still clutched cut into her palm as she eased back onto the mattress, huddled there in a fetal position, trying to control her breathing. Her heart was hammering so loud, she was afraid he would hear it. How had she slept through his approach every morning? Even the quiet sound of his footsteps seemed magnified to her heightened senses. They drew closer and closer, and she squeezed her eyes shut, praying he'd think she still slept. She hardly dared to breathe, as there was a tiny sound only feet away, the food being set down. But he didn't retreat, not right away. Did he suspect something? Or did he stay there like that every morning, listening to her breathe? She forced herself to draw oxygen into her lungs, and then release it in a slow, even rhythm. Her pulse was galloping in her veins, like a spooked wild thing. The moment stretched. Finally, she heard him move away. Relief streamed through her, turning her muscles lax. The paper made a tiny crinkling sound against her body. The footsteps stopped. Her heart in her throat, Whitney deliberately moved her arm, as if she was changing positions. The chain jangled. Praying he'd think that was the source of the sound he'd heard, she lay still again. A minute later, she heard the key in the door, the sound of it opening, then closing behind him. She pressed the hand fisted around the screw to her lips to stifle a sob that threatened. That had been too close. How much time did she have before the computer turned on and the alert sounded? If she wasn't showered and ready by the time the film started, the consequence would be predictable. She counted to 100 to make sure he wasn't coming back, and then withdrew the pages, rolled them into a tighter scroll, and moved the space left empty by the floorboard she hadn't replaced. She stuck the papers inside and refit the board before padding toward the shower, her thumb worrying the smooth, flat top of the screw. She mentally berated herself. If she was going to take a risk, this had been a stupid thing to waste it on. It was going to take brains and cunning to get out of here, so she needed to start using her... Her feet faltered to a stop. She ran her thumb over the top of the screw again. A flat head, it had a single groove running through the center of it. Whitney turned to stare in the direction of the bar. It was clamped to the wall at both ends. The clamp was secured by three screws on top, three on the bottom. Screws just like this one, flat heads. She recalled that much from her endless warm-up routines, mindless activity that allowed her to take stock of her surroundings. And she had. Whitney had spent plenty of nights testing the security of that bar, but it held tightly. She hadn't been able to pull it loose from the wall, even using all of her body weight. Her fingers closed around the screw again. It had taken all this time to figure out that it could be used for more than a lever. It might also work as a screwdriver.
Janie Willard, November 13th, 4:21 p.m.
I can do this alone,
Olivia said, sending Janie a sideways glance from the passenger seat of the car.
It'd be no big deal.
You're not doing it alone. Janey knew her friend was trying to reassure her, but it just made the sense of failure clog in her chest again, tighter and darker than before. It had been her idea to approach Newman about the photo shoot. But on Wednesday, she'd managed to get only as close as the hall outside his office, which was in the grungy storage room where the time clock was kept. She'd stood there, heart racing in her chest like a runaway locomotive, palms sweating, body shaking. Even if the man wasn't inside, she'd known all she had to do was press a button mounted on the wall that would summon him. And she'd realized that even if she saw him, she wouldn't be able to utter a word. Janey was finding it hard to forgive herself for that. The next day, Olivia had accompanied her. A deep fountain of shame welled up at the memory. Her friend had done the talking. It had been all Janey could do to stay in one place when her mind and body were screaming at her to bolt. Olivia had had to yank her inside when Newman had insisted they go into his office to talk in private. "I'm sorry, Kelsey." After all these years, she hadn't been able to manage a simple conversation, even if it might help them learn something about her sister's disappearance. The fact that a photo shoot had been set up, one for Olivia rather than Janey, should have comforted her. Somehow it just made her more miserable.
"Why are we waiting here?"
Olivia leaned forward and took the cigarettes from the glove box, lit one, and handed it to Janey. Her fingers fumbling, she drew deeply from it. But it didn't decrease the anxiety clawing through her. Not this time. A car pulled up beside them. A shaggy-haired boy got out, rounded the hood with a box in his hands.
"Janey Lynn Willard, you've been holding out on me."
Typical Olivia. She wasn't pissed when she recognized Cole Bogart, just intrigued. Reaching over, she snagged the cigarette back and placed it between her lips. Puffed.
"Don't tell me he's going to be our bodyguard."
"No." Cole opened the rear driver's side door and slid inside, pulling it shut behind him.
"This thing's a beauty. It'll take care of all your needs and more."
He looked at Olivia.
"I'm Cole."
Janey twisted around in her seat to face him. She hadn't been able to speak to Newman, but she'd managed a conversation with Bogart on Wednesday. She'd figured he'd have the expertise they needed. And if the guy thought he owed her something, he'd be likely to agree to her request without demanding too many details. She could feel Olivia's gaze on her. Then her friend drawled,
"I'm Olivia. Why don't you tell me how you figure into this little scenario of ours?" "Janey said you wanted a listening device. Or something that would record without a person knowing they were being recorded?" "I've checked out Ohio's law, by the way. It's a one-party consent state. So you're in the clear if you want to use the recording in some way."
Olivia looked impressed. Janey's always been the smart one.
"I need to know where you're going to use it."
"No," Janey said clearly. "You don't." Cole looked impatient.
"Look, I don't give a shit what you're doing. But I have to know some details. What kind of distance do you need? Where is the transmitter going to be? The settings have to be adjusted accordingly."
"We'll both be in the same room with the person." From there, Janey's plan got a bit murkier. Get Newman to agree to take photos similar to the ones on the website. Once they, rather, Olivia, had convinced him she was serious about the session, the man had opened up a little. Told them he'd taken artistic photos for dozens of girls in the area. Which made Janey even more certain that he was the one who'd taken Heather Miller's photos. And Kelsey's.
"You have to be really careful with this equipment. I used my mom's credit card for it, and I want to get it sent back before she sees the charge on her statement."
His voice grew more animated as he pulled off his gloves and opened the box.
"These are sweet devices. Since I wasn't sure how they were going to be used, I got more than one. You can record a conversation while you're in proximity to the person, or you can transmit the conversation to the recording mechanism from 30 yards away, so it makes a difference how you want it set up."
He stroked the contents inside the box with affection.
Olivia lowered her voice.
That means you could wait in the car, Janie. I'd be fine with him, and you'd still get to hear the whole conversation.
Wait. Cole looked up, his eyes narrowed. You'd be fine with who?
It's whom, Olivia informed him airily. Then frowned.
I think.
No, I'll be there with you. Janie wasn't that big a coward. At least she'd hate to think she was. You'll be safer with me in the room.
Cole looked from one of them to the other. Okay, so you're gonna be inside and not outdoors? Any chance this guy you're meeting has a jamming device?
A what? Janie asked. She reached for the cigarette again, noticed that her fingers were trembling. Damned the physical responses she'd never had total control over.
A jammer. If the guy you're meeting is technologically savvy, he might have the equipment to scramble the signal of your transmitter.
Olivia snickered. Doubtful. I'm surprised this guy even knows how to run a camera.
A cam...
Concern filled Cole's face.
Hey, you aren't by any chance meeting Herb Newman somewhere, are you?
Turning more fully in her seat, Janie narrowed a look at him. What do you know about Newman?
Other than the fact that his personal grooming sucks and he can live for a week off the food caught in his beard?
He shrugged.
Maybe I started doing some digging when I found those pictures of Miller on the web. I figured Farron might have taken them, but I can't see him uploading them to that site I found. At least, not while he and Miller are still hooking up. I asked around. Heard Newman's name mentioned. The guy claims to work for some sort of talent agency, takes headshots and stuff, and submits them for modeling jobs.
Janie couldn't read his expression.
Is that what he told you?
Something like that, she admitted.
And you want proof he's doing it, Cole said slowly. So you can, what, turn him in for taking skanky pictures?
She needed to find out whether he'd taken the pictures of Kelsey. And if he had, she wanted him investigated to see if he'd been involved with her sister's disappearance. But she wasn't going to explain any of this to Cole. Despite the favor he'd done her by obtaining the recording device, she had no reason to trust him. And Olivia, for once, was keeping her mouth shut as well.
So, you don't want to tell me?
He lifted a shoulder, started lifting equipment out of the box.
That's cool. But here's the thing. He's been using that empty lake house on Fuller Road, and since that party got busted there last month, the cops are doing a ton of drive-bys. Even Farron stopped going there for a while, which hasn't been good for his business.
No one said anything for a moment. Then Cole shook the hair out of his eyes and pulled out his cell.
Janie, give me your number.
Immediately wary, she asked. Why?
Because I'll hang out on the road across from the driveway, pretend I'm on the phone or something. And if I see a cop, I'll call you. Put your phone on vibrate.
She looked at her friend. Olivia shrugged as if to say, why not? So Janie obeyed, even though she wasn't certain she wanted to give him another way to contact her. Which made her a bitch. Because she was the one who'd asked him for a favor, and he hadn't hesitated before agreeing to it. Thanks for doing this. Cole nodded and finished punching the number into his phone before looking up again.
What time are you meeting him?
5:30. They'd had to make it early so Olivia's story of a group project meeting at the library would appease her foster parents.
There's no heat or electricity in the cabin, so he must be bringing in his own sources. I think you'll be okay. He's probably a perv, but with the two of you there, you should be safe enough. And if you aren't out after an hour, I'll come to the door.
Hear that, Janie?
Olivia took a last drag of their shared cigarette before grinding it out in the ashtray.
Our own personal white knight.
You don't have to do that. Because the words sounded rude even to her ears, she added. But thanks.
Yeah.
He put his phone away and picked up two pieces of equipment.
Which one of you am I going to wire with this thing?
Pull your car up on the other side of the garage.
It was the only greeting that Newman gave when he came up to their vehicle.
You'll be out of sight that way. Follow me, you can park next to mine.
Sort of bossy for a daytime school janitor, Olivia grumbled, after Janie buzzed the window up again. He's obviously been here before. Janie waited for the man to pull ahead. The semicircle drive was unpaved, so it had been difficult to know if she was even on it as she'd crept up toward the house. The drive was hemmed with trees and overgrown brush, but without their leaves, they'd provide little cover. The house was far enough from the road, though, that it would take a good eye to see a car parked out front in the dark.
Who hasn't? In the summer, we usually head over by boats, party on the little beach out back. That way, if the cops show up, we can be halfway across the lake before they even get down to us.
Janie pulled up alongside the man's car. Once again, Newman came over to her window.
I'm going to haul in equipment here.
He handed Janie a flashlight.
Once I get the door open, you can come in, but stay out of the way until I get things set up.
She waited for him to go back to his vehicle and start unloading things from his trunk. Then she turned to Olivia. Let's go over this one more time. Her friend threw herself back against the seat theatrically.
Again? Janie, we've practiced every scenario until my brain hurts. I know our stories.
Fingers clenching and unclenching on the steering wheel, Janie drew in a breath, then another. But deep breathing alone wasn't going to quell her anxiety, not this time. Please.
Okay, fine.
As the man made his first trek to the front porch, carrying a heavy suitcase in one hand, Olivia launched into the stories they'd rehearsed and refined repeatedly since Janie had hatched this idea. The familiar lines provided a measure of calm that the breathing hadn't. They'd thought of everything. Picking up the light, she looked at her friend. Ready? Olivia wasted no time once Newman had arranged the space to his satisfaction.
First, I want headshots. I'm going to send them to some modeling agencies. I heard there's a big demand for alternative looks, you know, piercings, dyed hair, tats.
She beamed a big smile at him.
That's right up my alley.
The room they were in must have once been a den. Like the large space they'd entered once inside the door, it had a huge stone fireplace on one wall, but empty bookcases covered two of the others. The spotlights he'd brought were situated in a way that made Janie figure he was going to use the blank wall next to the door as a backdrop. She inched over to the fireplace and sat on the stone step before it, her fingers brushing over the pocket with the tiny recorder inside. Cole had seemed sort of disappointed when they determined there was no need for the earpiece and transmitter. Janie had a feeling that he just wanted to play with the equipment. They'd tried out the recorder, though, and it would suit their purposes just fine. She slipped a hand into her coat pocket. Switched it on.
Yeah. The punk look is totally popular right now. I actually could show the shots we take to an agency I'm associated with. They might be able to get you a gig as a tattoo or piercing model.
Yeah?
Janie shivered. The propane heaters he'd set up on either side of the fireplace hadn't yet made a dent in the temperature. Newman seemed not to feel the cold. He'd slipped out of his parka and was busy taking pieces out of a suitcase, screwing them into his camera.
Yeah. It's a niche market, but last year one of the girls I put in touch with him got some good gigs as a goth model. A bunch of her pics are on stock photo sites.
Janie wondered if the girl was also on the site Cole had found on the deep web.
But it's not enough to just have the right look. You have to have unique photos that catch their eye. That's where I come in.
So, how does this deal work?
Newman brought up a camera and snapped an impromptu shot of Olivia as she slipped her coat off. She pouted, posed. He took another. When he lowered it, Olivia went on.
I mean, how do I make money off this gig? Can I get paid for these pictures?
She was sticking to the script. Janie's chest eased slightly. And, being her friend, Olivia hadn't even inquired too closely about Janie's insistence on this line of questioning.
You mean for these shots? Probably not. You make your money once the talent agency puts you in touch with clients that hire you as a model. Strike another pose.
Olivia obeyed, and the camera began to click and hum as he began to photograph her.
The agency...